here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening and thanks for being with us. On today's show, we bring you a conversation with Jeff Geipel of Fair Trade Vancouver and Claire Seaborn from the UBC Sustainability Office to discuss Vancouver becoming Canada's first major city to achieve fair trade town status and what's being done on the UBC campus to make it a fair trade university. We'll also have coverage of the upcoming Bike to Work Week on this edition of News 101. We'll have all this, plus your free speech radio news headlines, your arts report, and your weekday weather forecast this hour right here on News 101. No emotion in the way. And now first, your headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with today's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A U.S. drone fired two missiles in northwest Pakistan, killing at least 10 people and possibly as many as 20, according to Pakistani security officials. It's the second drone attack in the past week. Last Monday, three people were killed in a similar drone attack in North Waziristan. Also in the region, 30 reported Taliban members and 10 Pakistani soldiers were killed today in an ambush on a military search team. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder says the Obama administration plans to seek greater powers to hold terrorism suspects without reading them their Miranda rights. Currently, authorities can delay telling arrestees they have the right to remain silent and to an attorney, but that delay is permitted only if they believe the suspect has information that could put others in immediate danger, the so-called public safety exception. But speaking on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, Holder said that exception is not strong enough to deal with international terrorists.
We're now dealing with international terrorism, and I think that we have to think about perhaps modifying the rules that interrogators have. Yeah, we certainly need more flexibility, and we want the public safety exception to be consistent with the public safety concerns that we now have in the 21st century.
Holder says he will be working with Congress to change the law. Republicans have argued that terrorism suspects should be tried in military court and denied virtually all the legal rights of civilians facing charges, including Miranda rights. More than 30 people have been killed in a pair of explosions in a Russian coal mine, and rescuers are racing to save dozens more trapped inside. The first explosion on Saturday night trapped more than 50 miners. A second explosion 4 hours later trapped 19 rescue workers who had entered the mine. Russian officials say there's a 48-hour window before the areas where several of the miners are trapped will likely flood with water. A criminal investigation has been launched looking into possible safety violations at the mine, which is 2,000 miles east of Moscow. As negotiations continue to form a new government in Britain, Prime Minister Gordon Brown announced that he would resign as leader of the Labour Party. George Lavender reports.
Gordon Brown said he expected elections to be held for a new leader of the Labour Party before the party conference in September.
I have no desire to stay in my position longer than is needed. I therefore intend to ask the Labour Party to set and train the processes needed for its own leadership election.
No party gained an overall majority in the British general election last week, but the Conservative Party won the most seats. Brown said that result was a reflection on his leadership. Negotiations between the Conservative and Liberal Democrat parties over a possible coalition government had been expected to result in a Conservative-led administration, with David Cameron as Prime Minister. But the two parties continue to disagree on the issue of electoral reform. The announcement today means that Gordon Brown could continue as Prime Minister of a coalition government until a new leader of the Labour Party is selected. George Lavender, FSRN, London.
European governments and the International Monetary Fund have approved a rescue package of just under $1 trillion as they attempt to stem an economic crisis throughout the EU. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The markets are liking this unprecedented deal, especially the news that the European Central Bank says it'll do something it said it never would, buy up bonds or government debt. The package makes $77 billion for emergency loans available to countries like Spain, Ireland and Portugal, who may be on the brink of similar financial meltdown. Because European banks are so involved in each other's sovereign debt problems, more than $500 billion will go towards bilateral loan guarantees. They're hoping it'll get lending going again. The involvement of Goldman Sachs in the Greek crisis is also emerging today. Critics say they helped Greece create derivative contracts structured in a way that disguised the true extent of Greece's borrowing. Italy used a similar trick to mask its true debt with the help of a different US bank. Goldman Sachs says they kept to European Union rules, but told its shareholders today that it's subject to a number of investigations and reviews over its dealings with Greece. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
In Zimbabwe, the High Court today acquitted Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's ally Roy Bennett of terrorism charges. The decision follows a lengthy court battle in a case that would have led to a death penalty if he was found guilty. Davison Makanga reports.
The Movement for Democratic Change party says Bennett should now take his post as Deputy Minister for Agriculture. He was nominated last year but has not been able to occupy the office due to criminal charges against him. President Robert Mugabe repeatedly refused to preside over Bennett's oath of office due to the terrorism case, fueling accusations that the charges were politically motivated. MDC spokesperson Nelson Chamisa.
All the stumbling blocks have been cleared. So we are expecting to have tomorrow Honorable Bennett as a Deputy Minister of Agriculture because he is an angel. He has no case to answer.
Bennett's acquittal has also rekindled debate about Attorney General Johannes Tomana's fitness for office. Tomana is one of the sticking points in the Sheikh Inclusive Government formed last year. Now that he has lost one high-profile case, analysts say the MDC will have more legitimacy in calling for his dismissal. Davison Makanga, Free Speech Radio News.
Sunday's elections in the Philippines were plagued by malfunctioning voting machines, and polls were kept open an extra hour as more than 40 million people cast their vote for more than 50,000 candidates running for president, Congress, and local government seats. Violence was also a problem. At least 10 people were killed, and several towns postponed voting out of fear. This was the first major election to use electronic voting machines. There were hopes the new machines would prevent vote rigging, but problems ranging from electrical outages to clogged ballot slots led to waits as long as 7 hours at the polls. Senator Noynoy Aquino is expected to win the presidency. We'll have more coverage of the elections in the Philippines later this week. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is calling this weekend's parliamentary election a bitter defeat for her Christian Democrat Party. Results from the most populous state in Germany mean that Merkel's ruling coalition will no longer have a majority in the German parliament's upper house. The results will make it much harder for Merkel to push through tax cuts and legislation on health care and could thwart her plans to stop a planned shutdown of Germany's largest nuclear reactor in 2020. Many political analysts say Germany's participation in the economic bailout of Greece lost Merkel's party the support of many voters. And those are today's headlines. For Free Speech Radio News, from Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
And thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we have Jeff Geipel of Fair Trade Vancouver on the line and Claire Seaborn of the Campus Sustainability Office. She's a student intern and in studio to discuss Vancouver becoming Canada's first major city to achieve fair trade town status. That's upcoming on News 101. Stay tuned.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could, the only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A, positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And welcome back to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for being with us. On May 6th, Vancouver City Council unanimously passed a motion endorsing an application to become a fair trade town. This makes Vancouver the first major Canadian city to achieve such status. I'm joined in studio with Claire Seaborn. She's a student intern with the Campus Sustainability Office here at UBC, and also a student, obviously, and Jeff Geifel of Fairtrade Vancouver, who joins us on the line to talk with us as well about this recent passage of a motion endorsing this application. Thanks, both of you, for being with us.
Hi.
And are you there, Jeff?
Yep.
Great. Thanks for being with us again. So, I want to start off with Jeff, but Claire, please jump in at any time. What is Fairtrade Vancouver and what does it do?
Fairtrade Vancouver is a nonprofit group that promotes awareness and sales of fair trade in the Metro Vancouver area. And our goal is to combat poverty overseas and to connect Canadians to where the products are coming from.
Great. And fair trade can sometimes be broadly interpreted. But how does Fairtrade Vancouver define it?
For us, fair trade is basically the principle that we pay developing country farmers and producers a fair price for the products we enjoy so that they can enjoy the same kinds of lives we do here in Canada.
Great. And how does Fairtrade Vancouver achieve and work towards achieving that?
We do a lot of awareness in the community through social media such as Facebook, our website obviously, with educational meetups. And coming up at the end of May, we're going to have a Fairtrade Pavilion at the Vancouver Convention Center.
Great. And now I want to talk about the May 6th motion that passed unanimously in City Council. What was it all about?
Vancouver City Council has pretty much had an ethical purchasing policy since 2005, and it included fair trade products. This motion last Thursday basically reaffirmed their commitment to purchasing fair trade products and also declared support for our campaign to make Vancouver a fair trade town.
Great. And now does the fair trade town status, does that refer to working towards getting grocery stores and restaurants and businesses in the community to adopt similar practices like the city in its buying practices?
Well, there's a lot of components to the application. One of them is supermarkets and restaurants. And basically, there has to be a certain level of store-wide availability in the city. And so Vancouver had kind of already accomplished those goals through the market demand for fair trade products. And so, but another component, though, is support from community groups and workplaces and schools. And in that regard, Vancouver has got quite a lot of leadership in promoting fair trade.
And do you think that's why Vancouver is now the first major Canadian city to have passed such motion and achieved such status?
Oh, of course. I mean, I think the city government is responding to people wanting to know where the products come from, making sure they're environmentally sustainable, and that workers are paid fairly.
Great. And now, Claire, you're working as a student intern at the Campus Sustainability Office. What is what's the university doing to make the campus more sustainable and more ethical in their buying practices?
Well, the AMS and UBC Food Services are already providing some fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, and even bananas. But the Sprouts Food Co-op are really the leaders. They provide those things, but also dried fruit, sugar, and they use fair trade products in a bunch of their baked goods. And recently, UBC Supply Management and the Campus Sustainability Office have brought out a sustainable purchasing guide updated that features fair trade in the catering sections and the event planning sections. So that encourages faculties in different departments all over campus to buy fair trade when they're doing their purchasing.
Great. And so this is a question for both Claire and Jeff. Are there targets that maybe the university has set from the sustainability office and in this application that sort of set out goals and levels that the city would like to achieve in terms of the percentage of fairly traded items they purchase?
Do you want to take that one, Claire?
Yeah, sure. Well, there's the Vancouver City becoming a fair trade town, and then there's a completely separate application, which is UBC becoming a fair trade university. And both of these designations will come from Transfair Canada, the national body on fair trade. So for UBC to become the first fair trade university, which we're a candidate of, we're actually competing right now, mostly against the University of Waterloo and U Windsor in Ontario and McGill, so the race is getting pretty close. We hope to have our application done around September. But there's a number of things that we need to do. We're setting up a steering committee, which needs to have representatives from all sorts of different bodies on campus, like AMS, food services, some top-level VPs at the university. We need to increase awareness and sell more products on campus. And eventually, UBC's fair trade status needs to be made both university policy at the AMS and at the UBC administration level.
And so obviously, there may be similar elements in what the city is doing at the city level?
Well, I mean, the city's ethical purchasing policy has included fair trade products in 2005. And really what's happened is, after the last the policy was implemented, the last election saw a bit of lack of enforcement, and so this last motion on Thursday, the goal here is to reinforce that and start filling in the gap citywide when it comes to cafeterias and offices and the meetings. So we should see a sizable increase in the percentage of fair trade products being offered in the city and its offices.
Yeah, and similarly at UBC, hopefully, if we achieve fair trade status by around September, this will encourage various different bodies all over campus, because purchasing happens in a lot of different places, to buy fair trade. But we've already had really great support from UBC Supply Management and UBC Food Services so far.
Great. So often, though, fairly traded goods tend to cost more for consumers, and so this, you know, creates some barriers for lower-income people and often students. So is accessibility to fairly traded goods an issue?
Well, I would say it's important to remember that quite often a fair trade price for a product is actually the real price, and sometimes you end up with a product that's quite cheap, but the reason why it is cheap is because you're not paying for the labor, you're not paying for the environmental damage that it's causing. Quite often, some of the fruits you're seeing, the farmers aren't even being paid at all. Not even, it's not a case of a low price. They're just not getting paid, period. They're being lied to by their local buyers, not getting it paid. So that's the first important point to make. But the second is that the more people buy fair trade products, the prices should start to fall. Because right now, you have a kind of a supply issue. And when you're talking about a small market, you don't get access to things like bulk discounts and all that kind of thing. So, you know, the more people buy fair trade products, the more the price will fall.
Great. So are there any, we can leave it at that, or are there any other further comments from?
Oh, I also wanted to give a shout out to Engineers Without Borders, UBC chapter. It's actually Engineers Without Borders that have been spearheading a lot of the fair trade movements all over the country, especially at the university level. So Engineers Without Borders, good work so far, and keep it up.
Anything on your end, Jeff?
That's all I have, really. I just want to thank you for having us on today and helping us promote fair trade.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. And Claire, I want to thank you as well for joining us in studio. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Great. That was Jeff Geipel and Claire Seaborn joining us to discuss Vancouver becoming a fair trade town, first in Canada, first major city in Canada to achieve such status. And Claire was here talking with us about work going on here on campus to promote ethical purchasing and fair trade purchasing on campus. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver. We're going to take a quick break for some public service announcements, but stay with us. We've got more on the show.
Do you have an approaching test or exam and need help studying? Well, it's time to prepare yourself. The Study Van, www.studyvan.com, is a 100% free website dedicated to helping you achieve excellence. MCAT, History, Chemistry, French, Math, Biology, the Study Van covers it all. Tools are provided so you can create your own study group and do what you need to do. Ace your exam. The Study Van will help you help yourself. Give it a shot. You have nothing to lose, as once again, it is a 100% free studying resource. So remember, when you need to study, go to the Study Van, www.studyban.com.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
CITR podcast update number one.
Work has begun on Canada's information highway. That's the state-of-the-art network that we're told will change everything from the way we do business to the way we learn. Without getting too technical, tell me how what you're working on is different from what's available to me right now.
So right now, if you want to listen to your favorite CITR program, you need to be listening to it on your radio live or streaming over the internet live. But with CITR podcasts, you'll be able to download your favorite show and listen to it whenever you want on your computer or on your MP3 player.
I'm just thinking about that.
I know, it's pretty rad.
For more information, visit CITR.ca/podcast. Thank you for listening, and please be kind to robots.
Hi, this is Ron McLean of Hockey/Movie Night in Canada. You're listening to CITR 101.9.
Beans are mainly grown in the Lower Mainland, but there is some production in the Okanagan Valley and on Vancouver Island. Did you know that BC produces about 4 million kilograms of beans? This many beans would cover a football field to a depth of over 2 meters.
We've got so many beans, we're having a sale. A blowout sale. Fresh hot releases. Have you got wind of these deals? You smelt it, we dealt it. At the Bean Warehouse in Gastown, right behind Gassy Jack. This weekend only. And maybe next. Weekend. Do.
If you're worried you've got a problem with excess flatulence, do speak to your doctor about it.
This message has been brought to you by the Bean Farmers Association of British Columbia, Canada. Thank you for your warm support.
LiveBand.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. LiveBand.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit livemusicvancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. Liveband.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
And welcome back to News 101, broadcasting on 101.9 FM in Vancouver and streaming at citr.ca. Thanks for being with us. And now it's time for your weekday weather forecast. For that, we turn to Daniel Casanova. What's in store, Daniel?
Thanks, Andrew. Well, we can look forward to a sunny week ahead with high temperatures reaching up into the 20s and a slight chance of rain towards the weekend. Monday evening to the overnight, it will be partly cloudy with a low of 9 degrees. For Tuesday, it will be bright and sunny with a high of 18 and a low of 7. For Wednesday, it will be sunny with cloudy periods with a high of 17 degrees and a low of 7. For Thursday, it will be sunny again with a high of 20 and a low of 9 degrees. On Friday, we will have a mix of sun and clouds with a slight chance of isolated showers, a high of 20 degrees and a low of 10. On Saturday, we can expect to become cloudier with a high of 17 and a low of 10 degrees. And finally, for Sunday, we expect a mix of sun and cloud with a slight chance of showers, a high of 16 and a low of 7 degrees. Currently, it is 14 degrees and partly cloudy at YVR. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
And thanks for that forecast, Daniel. We're going to take a quick break and leave you with a tune, and we'll be right back with more news and coverage of Bike to Work Week after this break. Stay tuned. This is News 101 on CITR.
Was the name of her act, and it's true to love her is all I can do in a world that's beaten everything black and blue. They call it Silver Jenny Dollar, Silver Jenny Dollar, Silver Jenny Dollar. We're only ever passing through. Cartilage and sinew was the name of our act, and it's true, you noticed, it's all I can do in a world that's beaten everything black and blue. They are Silver Jenny Dollar, Silver Jenny Dollar, Silver Jenny Dollar. Winter's over, the war is over. A parcel of land men ask them, it's true, they'll love you. Silver Jenny Dollar,
And welcome back to News 101. That was The New Pornographers with Silver Jenny Dollar off their new album. And now it's time for coverage of Bike to Work Week. And it's less than a month away, and it's a major part of the Vancouver Area Cycling Coalition's work to increase cycling awareness in the region. I spoke with Aaron O'Mellon about the upcoming Bike to Work Week. Well, Aaron, thank you for joining me. And can you first start out by explaining what Bike to Work Week is, a little bit of the history of it here in Vancouver, and what the main goal of it is?
Sure. This is the fourth annual Spring Bike to Work Week put on by the Vancouver Area Cycling Coalition. And the aim of the event is to get new people out cycling for transportation and also to celebrate those people that regularly do cycle for transportation. It's a great way to be healthy, really cost-effective, and sustainably conscious. So we're trying to get more and more people out there all the time. And Bike to Work Week is kind of a friendly competition with lots of spots for celebration along bike routes.
Now, over the last few years, what's the level of involvement been? And can you compare it to the level of involvement you're seeing this year?
Sure. Since 2007, we've seen numbers over double in terms of our participation and the number of people that show up at our commuter stations around the region. And this year, we've just started our big promotional push to get people to start registering on the website. So we're pretty much on track. And our goal for this spring event is 8,000 registered participants.
Now, let's talk about registration a bit. So The goal is to get people to register prior in teams or in workplaces?
That's right. You can register in workplace teams or as an individual. There's lots of people that are self-employed or just want to have their own team where they can compete against their coworkers and compare stats. And that's fine. They can do it either way. It's totally free on our website. And you sign up and you can track live all of the updates of people to see who's got the most kilometers or commutes. You can see how many calories you're burning and how many GHGs you're saving from being emitted.
Now, there's a little bit of competition as well,
yes,
isn't
definitely.
There?
Yes, definitely. We have workplace awards, and so we give those out to a number of different size categories of organizations for the different distances they go, the number of commutes, and their participation level. And those are highly coveted awards that will be presented at our first ever Bike to Work Awards reception this year in June. So I definitely know that there's a rivalry begun between UBC and SFU, for example. And they will be cycling hard this season to try and beat one another.
Well, I'd say they're evenly matched in terms of the elevation that they have to climb. So
there's definitely a couple hills in there.
Yeah. So in comparison to previous years, have you been seeing larger offices or companies taking part in Bike to Work Week? Is there a growing trend in participation in Bike to Work Week?
There is, for sure, and we love getting large organizations on board because it only takes one or two champions in the workplace to show people that they ride to work, they have a great time, they get there and they feel wonderful, they actually feel like they had a good commute. And people see that and say, if they can do it, I can too. And so once you get that in a large organization, you obviously get even more people coming out and trying it. And then once they try it, they usually get hooked.
And what are some of the comments that you get from cyclists during Bike to Work Week? Maybe you can talk about, you know, cyclists or people who are new to cycling, who are just trying it for the first time and are just getting into commuting to work by bike. Is it a nice, easy way to start commuting to work by bike by
having
this initial?
It's a great time to start. if you're trying it for the first time, because there's so much support both online and on the bike routes with our commuter stations where you can stop and get free bike maintenance and some free refreshments, and there's tons of prizes. We'll be there with bike maps and advice if you need it, which is also always online. But it's also nice when you get to work to have that camaraderie with your teammates, and they can help support you and show you where to park your bike and if there's a shower where you can go and keep your stuff. So those are some of the small things that people think of as barriers sometimes, and Bike to Work Week really helps them to remove those barriers and then to be able to ride to work all year long.
Now I want to go back to talking about the commuter stations. So there will be stations across the city, to my understanding. And
across the city,
can you
and
talk
the
about
region.
What's offered?
All of Metro Vancouver will have stations, and we're expecting about 50 of them this year.
Wow! And now, are the stations going to be run primarily by volunteers, or how does that work?
There's a lot of volunteer involvement. We have a lot of local Vancouver Area Cycling Coalition committees, and a few people from the office that'll be out there. So it's kind of a joint community collaboration. And we welcome anybody that wants to volunteer with us to let us know. If you go to the website that has all this information at www.biketoworkmetrovan.ca, there's information about volunteering or the locations and schedules of the stations, so you know exactly where to show up and when. And definitely for UBC students, staff, and others, there's going to be two stations right on campus this year.
Okay. And what are some of the other major stations across Vancouver?
We have some really popular ones at Ontario and 10th, Main and Union, 7th and Arbutus are really big ones.
Okay. So you can maybe get a coffee and have your bike looked at as well at the same time?
Exactly. Yeah.
Great. And so I want to ask you, how does Bike to Work Week, obviously this is a major part of the VACC's work, how does it fit into the larger objectives of the organization?
The VACC is all about improving cycling conditions in the region, because we want to increase the cycling mode share, like most municipalities and TransLink do as well. And we believe that it improves the quality of life in our communities and helps people become healthier at the same time. So Bike to Work is one of our programs, one of many, that help to motivate people and get them excited about doing that. And we have other programs such as the Streetwise Cycling courses, which are very complimentary to Bike to Work Week. And they're offered to people that aren't super confident riding on the road and they're not sure what the rules are and responsibilities and how they should do that. So those new cyclists or cyclists that have been recreational for a long time often will take those courses in community centers or at workplaces and learn how to ride on the road safely, how to be really respectful and communicative, and that's a big part of what we do here too.
Now, for me, it seems like we're almost seeing sort of a cycling renaissance, and maybe Bike to Work Week has contributed to that, and maybe can you talk about, you know, cycling in Vancouver and really the emerging cycling culture and just as a community, the cyclists in Vancouver are having an increasingly more significant voice in the region. How does that play into the VACC's work, and how does that also relate to Bike to Work Week?
Sure. I think you're right. I think there is a cycling renaissance, and a lot more attention and investment is going into it, and it's wonderful to see. I know with the decisions yesterday at Vancouver City Council, some more money will be put into physical infrastructure that'll help people feel safer out on the roads and help make cycling for transportation seem a little bit more viable for them. And that's complemented by a lot of community work put on to get people excited and motivated about cycling. So Bike to Work Week is coming up, and then right at the end of that, Velopalooza will start, and there's a whole bunch of community-run events from June 4th to June 13th. They'll be happening. I think they're almost all free. And June is Bike Month, so there's a bunch of other things happening. We'll likely be hosting a Central Valley Greenway Great Ride from the VACC side of things, and we hope people join us for that.
Great. Well, is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners with, Erin?
Please go to the website and sign up now. You can recruit lots of teammates, and we've got amazing prizes for those that come up with the biggest team and the most kilometers.
Great. So what's the website again?
The website is biketoworkmetrovan.ca.
And the dates again for Bike to Work Week?
May 31st to June 6th.
And there's also a fall Bike to Work Week
there
as well.
There is. This year it'll be November 1st to 7th.
Awesome. Well, lots of things to look forward to.
Definitely.
Well, Erin, thank you so much. I really appreciate taking the time to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Take care.
You too.
And that was Erin O'Mellon talking with me about Bike to Work Week, which is upcoming in late June, or starting in late May, and ending on the 6th of June. It's now time for a quick break, but stay tuned. We've got your arts report coming up right here on News 101.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. You know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot? A salute?
Sore Throats, Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday at midnight on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so big pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. The Department of Art History, Visual Art, and Theory at UBC has just wrapped up a multi-day, multi-event conference called Breathless Days, exploring a critical moment in 20th century history, the years 59 and 1960. It featured not only lectures by prominent scholars, but also a film screening, concert, and art exhibit, all focusing on these 2 years. CITR Arts Director and host of the Arts Report, Adam Janusz, spoke with two organizing professors, Serge Guilbault and John O'Brien, before the start of the conference on May 1st. First, here's Adam speaking to Professor Serge Guilbault about Breathless Days.
Tell me about, let's just go over some of the actual events. What's featured over the next few days?
Well, there is a discussion today about architecture at the Belkin Gallery at noon, actually. But then one of the major things, there's two series of conferences, one on May 1st and one on May 2nd, 2 days, where we have invited some scholars from Canada, from the US, from France, and somebody who's going to talk about Latin America. This is an ongoing program, by the way. So we have done one in France, and we're going to do one in California next year. And then we have also, parallel to this, we have a program of curatorship here. We call it critical curatorship. Some graduate students have organized a show with some of the collection that we have here of those 2 years, which is kind of interesting because there we can see the multiplicity of voices, right? It's kind of very weird and bizarre and interesting. And also we borrowed some pieces from the VAG and also from a collector of photographs, you know, photography. So we have some very major pieces there, actually, in the show. And on May 7th, we have an extra day because we had to, it was difficult to have everybody in those 2 days, and also because we are invited and the French government has been helping very much into all this. We have Eric de Chassé, who is a prof at Tours University in France, but he's also now the director of the Villa Medici in Rome. So he's like the second of command of the culture after the Minister of Culture in France. And he's involved in promoting, so to speak, the contemporary art production, but also the Villa Medici is where you can go as a scholar and do research, and so they have a series of stuff like that. So because he's interested in contemporary art, what we'll do is going to give a lecture about 1560, about Alex Katz, a painter, pop art painter from the US, but at the same time we'll have a roundtable with Scott Watson, who's the director of the Birkin Gallery here, and me, and we'll talk about his vision of contemporary art, the problems with contemporary art, because we have tons of problems with contemporary culture.
Really?
Contemporary art. Oh, yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah, so what to do, how to do, where to do it, and all that stuff. So he's going to tell us his vision of what contemporary art scene is like, and the problems with it, how to select, how to present, who to present, and all that stuff. Mm. So this is very... Now it's becoming a very big, important political issue, because contemporary art is like the image that a country projects outside. It was always like that, but before it was simple. You had only two or three centers, big centers. Now those centers have disappeared. So it's a kind of a sea of production, and with a Biennale everywhere in every continent and countries. I mean, everybody wants to have one. We don't know why exactly, but it's like that. This idea of presentation. So he's going to talk about all those projects.
And then there's going to be some films.
Yeah. What we decided was to have two major film, those two years. So that's Godard, Aboudsouf, Breathless, but also Psycho Hitchcock, because those two were really major at the time, right? Everybody, the public went like crazy, and they were symptomatic, it seems to me, of that moment, right? Mm. One is the Breathless I was talking about, right? The deconstruction of the of language, and also the guy is cool. He's a cool guy. He's on the edge, of being a gangster. He doesn't know what he's doing really, and also he falls in love, so to speak, with this American girl. So his American French kind of connections, that was quite hot in those days, and Sacco, of course, it's all about fear, right? It's about the Cold War fear, but to transfer into a Sacco things with a tourist and the mother, and it's the Cold War seen through a kind of psychological thing, right? And psychoanalytic studies. Yeah. So it's quite. So those two movies represent exactly that, the moment perfectly. And what is interesting is that the French government again helped us to bring back the original film on 35mm, but revamped, right? Cleaned up and fixed and so on. So it's going to be a major event.
Wow.
See?
Remastered? And
yeah, well, not remastered, but you know what they do, like re-cleaned up and fixed, that's what you mean, remastered?
Yeah.
But it's the original thing, the plastic thing.
Oh, okay. The original film.
Well, yeah. Excellent. So that's what... And also, because when you project that through those old machines, you have a different feeling.
Yeah, it's there's kind a certain of quality that you don't have in digital film.
Yeah, so that's what it's on.
And now you'll hear Adam with Professor John O'Brien asking him if the multidisciplinary format is a new way for universities to explore these issues.
Is this a new way to cover... topics?
Well, we hope that it helps to explain, but you never arrive at a full explanation. You might arrive at a more satisfactory account because it's messier. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, the reality is always messy. So we would hope that, but it's going to be one more narrative. Mm. We hope it's a more adequate narrative, but I don't think we're going to make any big claims for actually landing on a. An explanation that is unassailable.
Tell me about the term radiography. Why use, something specific to X-rays?
Because both Serge and I are hugely interested in atomic culture. And I have to say, although we've both written about it, I'm spending a lot of time writing about it now. So I have a couple of, a book and an exhibition underway on the intersection of the atomic with the visual. And so radiographic seemed just like the right metaphor. You know, everything is lit by the light of the atomic blast. And even though it's invisible, you know, radiographic analysis, radiation's invisible, it can still penetrate. So it seemed like the right, and of course it's very much at the time, anxieties were never higher about things atomic than they were leading up to the Cuban Missile Crisis. So a radiographic analysis x-rays into what you can't see and makes it visible. So that's why we use the word.
What do you think are the lessons of that time, that moment in time where there was so much fear and sort of a confluence of politics and art and culture? What can we take out of that today in 2010?
Well, this was a moment of a new phase of globalization, of enormous acceleration and change because of jet travel and because of the dispersal of various forms of culture internationally.
And because of the Barbie doll.
And the Barbie doll. You've looked at the website.
I have.
The Barbie doll. Have you seen the YouTube clip on
it? Yeah. It's a good, it's a catchy jingle.
Very catchy jingle. But it dates itself. And so all that was happening then. Beginning, I would say, with the Bush administration earlier on, but came to a head in the Bush administration, the tensions within globalization that, first of all, were highly political, kind of a, you know, a reigniting of the Cold War with the Soviet Union for a while, the United States playing hardball, and then the financial meltdown, again, the word meltdown relates to things atomic, is another very particular chapter in the history of globalization. So I think it now seems as if maybe everything is not going to circulate the way we thought it was going to circulate. I mean, the way it seemed to have been circulating. It wasn't going to be American power still, right? It wasn't going to be, you know, goods going everywhere. Where in you know, the lessons of what's happened in the last, ever since 9/11 and then the financial meltdown, suggests something else. And I think that what in looking at 59-60, we can learn something from that period about the last decade.
Looking at art and those artifacts, you know, the films, the music, the visual art, is that a more accurate telling of the time than just a history book?
No, I wouldn't say that it's more accurate.
What's the difference then?
Art doesn't try to... Art makes no attempt to be accurate, and nor does it make any attempt to tell straightforward narrative, as history often. It works by indirection and by affectivity, how people respond. And that affectivity can spill over into the intellectual as well. So it does very different kinds of work. There's an allowance for a different kind of criticality within art that can be the revealing of a kind of self-understanding, self-reflection on the artist's part that can be conveyed to the viewer, to the reader, about what the process of making that art is under what particular social conditions. So art functions very differently.
And so what does that art say about 1959 and 60?
Well, it says that it's happening everywhere, and we used to like to think that really it only happened in New York and Paris, right? Well, we've, you know, since then we've certainly known that it happened in San Francisco and L.A. and London, but we didn't think much about Toronto or Vancouver.
Or Latin America.
Never mind Latin America or Asia. My God, beyond the pale. But we understand. I think we all understand now that at any one moment, extraordinary things are happening or extraordinary art is being made. Maybe it's not extraordinary. Most art isn't extraordinary. It's very banal and ordinary. But the potential for extraordinary work to happen anywhere in the world is there.
The art exhibition component goes until June 2nd at the Morrison Helen Belkin Art Gallery. It's called Breathless Days, 1959 to 1960, a chronotropic experiment. And you can get more info at www.belkin.ubc.ca. And that's our program for May 10th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at CITR.ca. Be sure to check the website for updates of CITR News' content. Brad Pepping produced this radio program. For more news, join us. And you can tune in again Friday at this time for a rebroadcast of this show. And we'll be preparing a new show for you on next Monday. And be sure to tune in. I'm Andrew Longhurst from the entire news team here at CITR. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Track right here on 101.9 FM CITR.